And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Remember last year when there was a lot of buzz about bees? Reports were coming in that honeybee hives were collapsing. Where once one would find 20 to 30,000 bees in any hive, there were now only hundreds. And in some cases, they were gone entirely. And the story got a bit strange, because the bees had just disappeared. The humble bumblebee, as anyone with half a dozen eggs should know, is the critical link between anther and stamen, which works the magic that makes the food we eat possible. Without the bees, remember the story? Well, it's bee time again in the orchards, fields, and farmlands. So how are we doing? The mystery of the bees continues when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The current era is filled with paradox. We are approaching the point where we can create life, while at the same time destroying it at an alarming rate. We have access to more of the history of our world and seem less willing to learn from it. We can carry 10,000 songs on our iPod, but don't have time to dance. We can change the genetics of seeds to make bigger, stronger, faster-growing crops, but won't have bees to pollinate them. Perhaps the greatest paradox of all is that we have more choices than ever before, but our options are becoming fewer. During our first segment, we get a great talking to by an advanced advocate of thought, as Richard Dawkins addresses us with "Even Queerer Than We Can Suppose" during the weekly Earth Summit. Coming up in just a moment. That will be followed by this week's Nature News and an announcement of a great new Wild Side News feature launching this Friday around the world. And then in segment two, we revisit the subject, to be or not to be. What's happened since last year's big story that honeybees were just disappearing? It's springtime in the orchards, and trucks laden with hives filled with bees are spreading out around the country to make sure our food gets pollinated, or so we hope. We'll bring you an important update on the status of bees in segment two. It's a great and amazing show coming up, and it all begins right now. So now it's time for the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and we continue our quest to bring you important voices of our time, and voices that expand the understanding of life on Earth. That certainly is the case with today's guest, Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist, ethologist, author, and thought provocateur. His ideas on science, religion, and overpopulation inspire and provoke strong reactions around the globe. His recent efforts to help establish rights for the great apes may seem a paradox to some who know him best as an avid atheist and secularist. So be it. So it is with great pleasure that I introduce Richard Dawkins.
My title, Queerer Than We Can Suppose, The Strangeness of Science. Queerer Than We Can Suppose comes from J.B.S. Haldane, the famous biologist, who said, Now, my own suspicion is that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. I suspect that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of or can be dreamed of in any philosophy. Richard Feynman compared the accuracy of quantum theories, experimental predictions, to specifying the width of North America to within one hair's breadth of accuracy. This means that quantum theory has got to be, in some sense, true. Yet the assumptions that quantum theory needs to make in order to deliver those predictions are so mysterious that even Feynman himself was moved to remark, "If you think you understand quantum theory, you don't understand quantum theory." It's so queer that physicists resort to one or another paradoxical interpretation of it. David Deutsch, in The Fabric of Reality, embraces the many worlds interpretation of quantum theory, because the worst that you can say about it is that it's preposterously wasteful. It postulates a vast and rapidly growing number of universes existing in parallel, mutually undetectable, except through the narrow porthole of quantum mechanical experiments. What is it that makes us capable of supposing anything? And does this tell us anything about what we can suppose? Are there things about the universe that will be forever beyond our grasp, but not beyond the grasp of some superior intelligence? Are there things about the universe that are in principle ungraspable by any mind, however superior? The history of science has been one long series of violent brainstorms as successive generations have come to terms with increasing levels of queerness in the universe. Science has taught us, against all intuition, that apparently solid things like crystals and rocks are really almost entirely composed of empty space. And the familiar illustration is the nucleus of an atom is a fly in the middle of a sports stadium, and the next atom is in the next sports stadium. So it would seem the hardest, solidest, densest rock is really almost entirely empty space, broken only by tiny particles so widely spaced they shouldn't count. Why then do rocks look and feel solid and hard and impenetrable? As an evolutionary biologist, I'd say this: our brains have evolved to help us survive within the orders of magnitude of size and speed which our bodies operate at. We never evolved to navigate in the world of atoms. If we had, our brains probably would perceive rocks as full of empty space. Rocks feel hard and impenetrable to our hands precisely because objects like rocks and hands cannot penetrate each other. It's therefore useful for our brains to construct notions like solidity and impenetrability, because such notions help us to navigate our bodies through the middle-sized world in which we have to navigate. Moving to the other end of the scale, our ancestors never had to navigate through the cosmos at speeds close to the speed of light. If they had, our brains would be much better at understanding Einstein. I want to give the name middle world to the medium-scaled environment in which we've evolved the ability to take action. Nothing to do with Middle Earth, middle world. We are evolved denizens of middle world, and that limits what we are capable of imagining. Unaided human intuition, schooled in middle world, finds it hard to believe Galileo when he tells us a heavy object and a light object, air friction aside, would hit the ground at the same instant. And that's because in middle world, air friction is always there. If we'd evolved in a vacuum, we would expect them to hit the ground simultaneously. If we were bacteria, constantly buffeted by thermal movements of molecules, it would be different. But we middle worlders are too big to notice Brownian motion. In the same way, our lives are dominated by gravity, but are almost oblivious to the force of surface tension. A small insect would reverse these priorities. So really isn't a word that we should use with simple confidence. If a neutrino had a brain which had evolved in neutrino-sized ancestors, it would say that rocks really do consist of empty space. We have brains that evolved in medium-sized ancestors which couldn't walk through rocks. really, for an animal, is whatever its brain needs it to be in order to assist its survival. And because different species live in different worlds, there will be a discomforting variety of realies. What we see of the real world is not the unvarnished world, but a model of the world, regulated and adjusted by sense data, but constructed so it's useful for dealing with the real world. The nature of the model depends on the kind of animal we are. A flying animal needs a different kind of model from a walking, climbing, or swimming animal. A monkey's brain must have software capable of simulating a three-dimensional world of branches and trunks. A mole's software for constructing models of its world will be customized for underground use. A water strider's brain doesn't need 3D software at all, since it lives on the surface of the pond in an Edwin Abbott flatland. I've speculated that bats may see color with their ears. The world model that a bat needs in order to navigate through three dimensions catching insects must be pretty similar to the world model that any flying bird, a day flying bird like a swallow, needs to perform the same kind of tasks. The fact that the bat uses echoes in pitch darkness to input the current variables to its model, while the swallow uses light, is incidental. Bats, I've even suggested, use perceived hues such as red and blue as labels, internal labels, for some useful aspect of echoes, perhaps the acoustic texture of surfaces, furry or smooth and so on. In the same way as swallows, or indeed we, use those perceived hues, redness and blueness, etc., to label long and short wavelengths of light. There's nothing inherent about red that makes it long wavelength. And the point is that the nature of the model is governed by how it is to be used, rather than by the sensory modality involved. Perhaps dogs and rhinos and other smell-oriented animals smell in color, and the argument would be exactly the same as for the bats. Middle world, the range of sizes and speeds which we have evolved to feel intuitively comfortable with, is a bit like the narrow range of the electromagnetic spectrum that we see as light of various colors. We're blind to all frequencies outside that. Middle world is the narrow range of reality which we judge to be normal, as opposed to the queerness of the very small, the very large, and the very fast. And we could make a similar scale of improbabilities. Nothing is totally impossible. Miracles are just events that are extremely improbable. A marble statue could wave its hand at us. The atoms that make up its crystalline structure are all vibrating back and forth anyway. Because there are so many of them, and because there's no agreement among them in their preferred direction of movement, the marble, as we see it in middle world, stays rock steady. But the atoms in the hand could all just happen to move the same way at the same time, and again. In this case, the hand would move and we'd see it waving at us in middle world. The odds against it, of course, are so great that if you set out writing zeros at the time of the origin of the universe, you still would not have written enough zeros to this day. Evolution in middle world has not equipped us to handle very improbable events. We don't live long enough. In the vastness of astronomical space and geological time, that which seems impossible in middle world might turn out to be inevitable. And life could originate once per planet, could be extremely common. Or it could originate once per star, or once per galaxy, or maybe only once in the entire universe. If life has arisen on only one planet in the entire universe, that planet has to be our planet, because here we are talking about it. And that means that if we want to avail ourselves of it, we're allowed to postulate chemical events in the origin of life which have a probability as low as 1 in 100 billion billion. I don't think we shall have to avail ourselves of that, because I suspect that life is quite common in the universe. But when I say quite common, it could still be so rare that no one island of life ever encounters another, which is a sad thought. If the universe is queerer than we can suppose, is it just because we've been naturally selected to suppose only what we needed to suppose in order to survive in the Pleistocene of Africa? Or are our brains so versatile and expandable that we can train ourselves to break out of the box of our evolution? Or finally, Are there some things in the universe so queer that no philosophy of beings, however godlike, could dream them?
Thank you, Richard Dawkins. Yes, life is even queerer than we can suppose, and that, unfortunately, is the problem. Many in science actually believed they could figure it all out. But as Mr. Dawkins makes clear, probably not in our lifetimes. If you'd like to learn more about Richard Dawkins, you can visit his website at www.richarddawkins.net. And I want to thank TED.com for making this all possible. So until next week, when we meet again to hear the most important 15 minutes on Earth, you can look forward to joining us at the Weekly Earth Summit. In just a moment, we'll bring you this week's Nature News Update. But first, this Friday, the Wildside News is advancing into the world of mainstream media as you'll be able to watch the Wildside News Update on YouTube. Each week, we'll be featuring a concise broadcast to bring you and the rest of the world the latest Wildside News. So, beginning this Friday, go to YouTube and just search for Wildside News. See you there. And now, our Nature News Update. Yellowstone National Park, home to some of the country's more exotic creatures, including grizzlies, moose, bison, and wolves, is, however, missing one of the more common species. There aren't any jackrabbits in the park. The last sighting of a jackrabbit was in 1991, and in Teton Park, they've gone unseen since 1978. No one really knows why. What is known is that their absence could be altering the dynamics within the ecosystem, as missing strands and food webs always do. For example, coyotes, which have a mythic relationship with the rabbit, are having to rely on alternate prey, perhaps even shifting their feeding up the chain to larger but younger prey, such as young elk, pronghorn, and other ungulates. Researchers are exploring the feasibility of reintroducing jackrabbits back into the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Bats are dying and disappearing in record numbers from caves in New York, Massachusetts, and Vermont. Dramatic reductions of 50% and more have occurred in various caves in the northeast regions. One possible cause is a white fungus that affects the animal's respiratory system. Bats with the white nose syndrome seem to burn up their fat reserves faster than healthy bats, which can lead to their death from the elements. Some people are pointing to a possible correlation with the sudden disappearance of the honeybees last year. At this time, no reliable explanation has been determined. Populations of tiger, bull, dusky, and other sea sharks have crashed by more than 95% in the last 35 years as fishermen kill the animals for their fins. The sharks are hunted and caught as bycatch in the large oceanic fishing nets. When caught, the fins are hacked off and the animals dumped back into the sea. Millions of sharks are taken this way each year in the unrestricted fishing regions of the open seas. The decline of numerous shark species has caused many of the species to be added to the endangered species list. The hammerhead shark, although not a fish of great worth as meat, nevertheless are prized as their fins are considered a particular delicacy in Japanese restaurants. The UN has recently adopted a resolution calling for immediate shark catch limits and a ban on shark finning. Conservationists are praising India's efforts to set up 8 new reserves to protect their dwindling tiger populations and to support more aggressive actions to thwart the illegal trading in tiger parts. The reserves are expected to be set up within 5 years. Currently, India's tiger population is estimated at 1,400, down from 3,600 just 5 years ago. The overall population of tigers in Asia is estimated at around 3,500, down from nearly 5,000 in 1997. Energy executives meeting in Houston this week are debating whether there is an oil crisis looming in the not-too-distant future. With population and industrialization, particularly in India and China, placing increased demands on existing oil reserves, many in the industry see the potential for shortfalls in meeting the increasing needs when they are witnessing a general decline in oil output of 4.5% per year. It was estimated that the world needs to find one major new source of oil comparable to the North Slope reserves every year to meet the demands. Oil executives are urging a significant increase in investment in securing and exploiting sources for future energy. And finally, U.S. institutional investors have pledged to invest $10 billion within the next 2 years in technologies that aim to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Institutional investors such as CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement Fund, have literally trillions of dollars in their holdings. John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, told the summit that some of the $5 trillion of the union workers' retirement should be invested in ways that help fight climate change and, in the process, create millions of new jobs. And that's the news. To be or not to be? That is the question. The mystery of the bees continues when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
You remember the stories from last year, big news about how honeybees were disappearing, just disappearing from hives around the country. Big news, lots of buzz, but like the bees, which just disappeared, so too the story. That is until now, because it's year two of CCD, Colony Collapse Disorder. In just a moment, we talk with two professional beekeepers about this year's follow-up as we ask, to be or not to be, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Well, here we go with the kind of the second year of CCD, Colony Collapse Disorder, that affects bees all over the United States and actually quite a bit around the world. Last year, about this time, we talked with David Hackenberg. He's the owner of Hackenberg Apiaries in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. And right now he's in California and he's doing his job. David, welcome back to the Wild Side News.
Glad to be here.
It's been a year. You attended a conference this last month in Sacramento. A lot of people talking about what's happening with bees. What was your takeaway from that?
Well, first of all, it was a kind of a historic meeting because both national organizations met together and proved, I guess, that there's probably a lot more beekeepers in the United States than that interested in going to the meeting to find out what's going on, because there's over 1,300 people showed up. I guess most of the meeting was geared, basically, I mean, it's, the biggest hot topic at that meeting was CCD. I mean, that's what everybody in this country is talking about. Of course, around the world, there was people there from, you know, Canada and Mexico and other parts of the world, and everybody's talking about the same thing, what's killing their oil. Where are their bees going? They're not, you know, why are they disappearing? And, I mean, it's like nothing anybody's ever seen before.
Was there any consensus? Are they making progress in terms of finding out what's going on?
Not really in reality, because, you know, there's a lot of work being done. There was a lot of things we have found out in the last year. I mean, when I say we, I'm talking about the scientists. My operation and several other operations across the country have been part of some large research projects, and some of the most interesting things we're finding out is that, you know, one of the things we have definitely learned this past year, there's a new type of Nosema out here that we knew was in Europe, but we weren't sure it was in the United States, but now we know it's here. But when we go back and look, I say we, the scientists, going back and looked at old samples that were stored, they found this back in the late 90s. We know as of 97, Nosema serrana was here, so that could be one of the factors, but that's not the answer. One of the other things that made a lot of headline news this past year was the fact that the Australian bees that are coming into the United States are carrying a virus, an Israeli acute paralysis virus, and I mean that made a lot of headlines midsummer and late early fall. But going back and doing some more studies back into the early 2000s, we know that that virus was here as early as 2002. We know that virus was on the East Coast, and it probably came in on Australian bees that went to Canada first in the 80s, and then came back through as shake bees in the fall and into this country. There's a lot of other little things looked at that maybe stress. People talk about the stress of us moving these bees all over the country, and nothing's really changed in the stress situation. We've been doing this. There's guys here that have been doing this here to California for 30 years. I've been moving bees on the East Coast for 40 years. And, yes, we hammer them a lot harder than we used to because there's a lot less of them and a lot less of us beekeepers to get the job done. But we've run some, the scientists have run some stress studies. In fact, we're involved in myself and another gentleman and out the East Coast are involved in some stress studies right now that are moving bees back and forth, and they're basically following some bees that they're making this trip back and forth between the East Coast and the West Coast, and gonna follow them all spring to see what stress may have on those bees. Maybe the most startling thing that has come out. There's been a lot of startling things that we have found in the last year that may be affecting the bees' health. There's a lot of things affecting their health, but probably the most startling thing is Penn State University is doing some research with insecticides and looking at what's really in the bees' food that they're consuming, what they're bringing into the field, in the pollen. And a laboratory, a USDA laboratory in North Carolina that's capable of running tests and coming up with all the answers, what's in these samples of pollen and the bee bread, which the bees feed their young. It's kind of staggering to find out that we're finding anywhere as high as 17 different insecticides and maybe 30 different fungicides in samples of pollen. The average sample of pollen they collected had at least 5 to 6 different insecticides, some as high as 17 different insecticides. We're talking about a grain of pollen the size of the tip of your end of your little finger. And as been said before, honeybees are really the barometer of the environment. I mean, you set honeybees down in one location and they can fly for miles and gather food and bring that back to their hive. And so anything that's out there, it's blooming, they're coming in contact with it. So maybe, we've never looked at these things before, but something definitely, and we're not only finding the old conventional chemicals, some of them have been around haven't even been used for 10 years, still showing up in the pollen, but we're also finding new systemics. Some of us out here think maybe one of the major causes of this problem, and what I'm referring to there is the new class of chemicals that basically came about around the turn of the century and have become used widespread in the last several years. I mean, it's these systemic chemicals we're using everything from corn to soybeans to cotton, vegetables, the apples we pollinate, the citrus our bees pollinate, the melons, your lawns, your dogs, your cats. I mean, it's what you treat your dogs and cats with for fleas are all these nicotinoid systemics. The thing about these chemicals is the manufacturers, in their tests say they don't kill adult bees, but we agree with that they don't kill adult bees, but something is basically messing up the bees, and basically what we have here is birth defects in the young and the second and third generation, and something is messing with the young.
It's kind of interesting because I've kind of followed the news here, and I'm a biologist myself, and as I look at this, the challenge is the fact that, you know, if it was typically parasitic or some other fungus or whatever it may be, you would typically find, I think, you would find just basically dead bees in colonies. I think the mystery here is the fact
Correct.
That the bees are just disappearing. And that raises a whole new question as to what in the world is going on. I mean, you've witnessed bee die-offs in the past due to some of the parasitic attacks.
Correct, yes.
And am I right?
And when you find that, you find the ground covered with dead bees, and you find, you know, we find a lot of symptoms. You know, it's not hard to find mite damage and, you know, and so forth. And if you have conventional spray kill from their old organic phosphates and all the old hard chemicals, I mean, that was pretty easy to tell. I mean, it got you, you know, that they put the spray on today and the bees were dead tomorrow.
Right.
In this situation, you know, where we're putting the chemicals in the ground and it's growing up through the plant, or we're putting it on as a foliar spray and the plant's absorbing it and it's going into the tissues of the plant and feeding the plant. And then, you know, the other thing we're really concerned about, and we've had several instances of beekeepers where they come in, especially in sod operations where there are bees next to large sod operations where we're finding a lot of bees collapse or disappear or what late fall. We're starting to wonder whether or not we're not picking a lot of this product up out of the groundwater. The bees consume a tremendous amount of water to raise their young, and they got to get it someplace. And, you know, they get it out of shallow groundwater, laying in ditches. And, of course, there's a lot of wild plants that grow in these ditches and, you know, golf courses or ponds that collect their runoff from their greens and so on and so forth. If you have bees in those areas, you go visit those ponds and you'll find just the ground just covered with bees on the edge of the ponds getting water to carry back to their hive.
Is it neonicotinoids? Is that correct?
Oh, neonicotinoids, yes.
Neonicotinoids, yeah.
You know, it's a new, you know, there's six different classes of neonicotinoids and probably 120 or 30 different chemicals and trade name chemicals that are out here that are the product or made from, but the active ingredient is the family name of the chemical is neonicotinoids. It's actually a nicotine, artificial nicotinoid base, and it basically, it's just like people, you know, taking tobacco, your body absorbs it, and that's just what the plant does. It absorbs this stuff into the tissue, and it goes up through, and basically, you know, it the sucking insects that suck on plants, it basically it affects those insects because that's how it's made to work.
And what does it do to those insects? Does it kill them, or does it...
The insects lose their immunity. They break down their immune system. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't kill anything. I mean, outright. It basically breaks down immune system so that other things and, you know, can take them out. Termites, who, you know, are kind of related to honeybees, and they only have three receptors in their brain, and they're, you know, and it's not really related, but they're in, you know, somewhat... The method, if you look in the literature and how these products break, or how these products affect termites, and it's chemical use really heavily on termites today, it breaks down their immune system and causes a memory loss so they can't find their way home and causes the insects to quit feeding. And amazingly enough, that's exactly what we see going on inside a beehive. The bees' first signs is the bees won't feed. You know, in the fall of the year, we feed the bees sugar syrup to build them up to get them through the winter. Put feed back in their hives so they have something to winter on, and the bees, first thing you see is that the bees won't take this feed down. I mean, and bees in the fall when there's nothing else out there, the bees are going to take anything that's sweet, and they just refuse to eat. It's just like humans, you know, when we're sick, we don't want to eat. You know, a couple weeks ago by, maybe a month ago by, and all of a sudden the populations start to dwindle. They're trying to raise brood to compensate for the bees they're losing, and eventually the hive just, you'll see within a matter of a couple days or several weeks, the hive just dwindled down from a good busting, you know, 15,000-20,000 bees in a hive down to a handful of bees and a queen, and everybody, there's no dead bees in the ground, everybody has flew off.
you had 1,300 people at that conference, many beekeepers and people doing research. What's the report from the field in terms of the status of bee colony collapse this year? Because about this time that people are starting to open up their colonies to see how they're doing, what's kind of the word on the street?
Well, the word out here in the street is that, the first thing, beekeepers are kind of an interesting bunch of people. First thing they got to do is raise their hand and say, it's like, hey, I got a problem here. But the word is that a lot of operations have lost at least 50% or more of their bees. I mean, large operations, small operations. We visited with a very small beekeeper this morning in an almond orchard that has lost over half his bees. Some of the larger beekeepers in the United States have lost way over half their colonies since last fall. And we're no different. I mean, we've suffered the same. We've suffered 50% losses since the bees that went south in the fall.
How about the backyard beekeepers?
We're talking to those kind of people, not every day, but we get calls from those people looking for bees to replace their bees come spring. And we're already hearing out of a lot of people that their colonies have dwindled down. Well, they got the handful of bees left. So this is in the north as well as the south. It doesn't seem like there's any place anymore exempt. I'm here in California, and California last year at this time, beekeepers, especially California beekeepers, said we don't have a problem. Well, guess what? This year the tide has turned. There's some very large operations here in California in some serious trouble, as well as small operations. A lot of operations have lost 50% or more of their bees this year.
Looking out, how long is it before this becomes just within the bee colonies themselves and the beekeepers? I'm not even talking from an economic perspective, but just actually the strength of the hives. Do you see this reaching a sort of a tipping point?
Well, there's already beekeepers that, are saying that, if we can't, we're going to try this, they lost bees last year and we lost bees again. We're going to try it one more time, and if it doesn't make it, this is all she wrote. I mean, there's bankers that are already have told their customers, beekeeper customers, that, I can't give you no more money, or, I just can't loan you money on bees that I'm not sure going to be here, for collateral. And so that's a serious situation. I'm here in California. I've been here for several days, and their crews have been here for 2 weeks now putting bees out. And we're talking to people that they've got the problem. Some of the best beekeepers in the country. I mean, people that I got a lot of respect for have the same problems we got, and it doesn't matter. It don't matter if you're a good beekeeper, a bad beekeeper, where you were or what you were. It's where your bees were and what they came in contact with last summer, last spring, maybe last winter. It's not a good thing. Here in California, they're talking about we got 1.2, 1.3 million beehives sitting here right now in this valley pollinating the almond crop or getting ready to pollinate the almond crop. They're just starting to bloom. Next year, they're going to need more bees. The following year, they're going to need more bees. By 2010, 2012, they're talking somewhere about 1.5 to 1.6 million hives of bees. We're having a hard time. I mean, we know right now that there's bees out here that aren't up the power to be pollinating the almonds. I mean, growers are having beekeepers pull bees out that aren't making grade, and trying to find bees to put in there to make grade, and it's not a good situation. Several of us that are out here together, this is our, I've been here before over the past years, but we didn't come to California, so there's four of us here actually working together, and we brought close to 9,000 or 10,000 hives of bees out here and out of Florida and the East Coast, and we're new players on the block. I mean, we're not new at pollination. We've been doing this all our lives, all four of us. But brokers are telling us that they're needing bees to fill these holes where there's bees that aren't making grade, and they don't know where to get them.
Well, part of the challenge here is conceivably a tug of war between the producers. I weigh in on the neonicotinoids. I just think that based on the science, that seems to be, they became very popular about, 2 or 3 years ago, and there seemed to be a correlation between the appearance of neonicotinoids used in crops and fields and then the onset of CCD. The tug of war is the economic interest of the producers of this. They make, I don't know what the money is, but it's big, big, big money because they're using these all over the world. Do you sense any sense of responsibility that they're going to look at this and say, maybe we've got something that's going here that's wrong? Because if that is the problem, then we simply have to address it.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question you asked there, because on the farmer side, and, you know, and I can relate to the farmer because he's up against it. He needs all the good technology he can get. But you talk to the farmers that are using these products, whether it's a vegetable grower or citrus grower or a corn or soybean or cotton grower, and, you know, I know a lot of people personally that are in these businesses, and they'll tell you this is the best thing that ever came down the pike.
That's the challenge. It works,
you know,
yeah.
I have a nephew that's in the lawn care business, and, you know, and he tells me, you know, this gets everything, you know, it kills everything. Well, it's exactly, you know, they're exactly right, and it's a soft chemical. It's not supposed to hurt anybody, and that's something I don't think anybody does really know. I mean, the work that was done on honeybees, it was only done as on LD50s, and for your listeners that don't know what that is, basically, EPA requires the chemical company to run their own test. They don't run any tests anymore. They require the chemical company to run their own test, and that's a test on how long it will take to kill adult bees. Mm-hmm. Well, this stuff doesn't kill adult bees,
right,
because it doesn't work in that mode. And scientists and others have asked and said, you know, you need to look at the long range, the birth defects, just like I said before, that the long range situation. But EPA doesn't require that. And it's basically what we're looking at here is a memory situation. And, you know, maybe with the rise of autism in children and young people, maybe it's something we need to look at. I mean, maybe the medical community needs to look at why in the last several years this autism has gone ballistic.
That's very interesting.
Our bodies are what we eat, and the same way with honeybees, you know, autism is a memory situation.
You know, as I think about this, it makes me think of the effects of marijuana. It's sort of like, you know, long-term use of marijuana leads to pretty significant memory loss and dysfunction over time, you know.
That's
people
right.
Just can't really quite remember what's going on. And, I mean, and we acknowledge that that's the effect, and it's a challenge here, and personally, I'm weighing in on that. It's a really difficult problem because, as you say, the farmers and the agriculturalists really like the neonicotinoids, but unfortunately, there's this backside, and perhaps in the years ahead, we'll be able to figure out how to address this, but it sounds as if right now, the problem with CCD is continuing and not getting any better.
You're correct. The scientists believe it's probably a lot worse. I mean, you know, USDA people, or Jeff Pettit and others at USDA, you know, are saying that, you know, what they're hearing out here in the field is it's a lot worse than it was a year ago.
Well, now you're out in California. Then on a personal note, where are you headed next?
I'll be going back to Florida here in a couple of days, and we'll be basically getting these bees. You know, they'll be here for about 3 weeks or so, and then we'll be loading these bees up, send them back to Florida for several weeks, and then they'll be headed back to the north to pollinate apples and blueberries and up the East Coast for another long summer.
Well, you know, it's, I'm sure, a challenging life in many respects, and yet at the same time, it's a romantic life. I like to be on the road. I kind of envy you, but I know you work real hard. So,
well, we do a lot of day and a lot of night work, but the neat part is that we get to see a lot of country and meet a lot of people, you know, it's kind of rewarding. I mean, there's a lot of challenges out here, but it is rewarding.
How long have you been doing this, David?
I started keeping bees in 1962 as a little ag project in high school, and it's all I've done all my life, and I guess that's, 40-some years ago. And actually, this makes 41 years that I'm based out of Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. I have an operation in Florida and just north of Tampa. We've been running back and forth between the East Coast for 41 years.
Well, David, you're the owner of Hackenberg Apiaries in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Do you invite people to get a hold of you?
Yes, they can visit us. We have a website with the Hackenberg Apiaries, www.hackenbergapiaries. I think it'll bring it up. And our email address is buffyb@thejazz.com, and they can you know, send us an email.
Why don't you spell that for us?
Buffy B, BuffyBee, at thejazz, DEJAZZD.
I'm glad you spelled it. I would have gotten that wrong. David, I know you're busy, and so I'm going to let you go, and we're going to keep in touch here. I wish you so much luck, and hopefully we'll be able to resolve this, and you call me anytime that you have got something to share.
All right. Appreciate it.
In just a moment, we're off to South Dakota as we talk with a beekeeper on his way back home after checking up on his hives in Texas. How are they doing? We'll find out. We continue our discussion of what's happening with bees this year, kind of the second serious year of CCD, colony collapse disorder. And now joining us, actually from on the road, as he's returning back to his home in Ortonville, Minnesota, is David Ellingson. David, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you.
First of all, tell us about your kind of heading back home.
Well, we went down to Texas to take a check for one thing, to see if everybody was alive or not alive and how well they were doing.
And how were they doing?
Well, it looked like about a 15% loss up till last Thursday, and then we went through the hives, and you could say we've been blessed by a nice three-week duration of nice weather and some pollen flow. So the good hives have done some growing with the feed that we gave them and the pollen substitute. But then there's the other 10% that we looked at that are just another horror story from last year.
Tell us the story.
Well, the good ones, you open them up, and, of course, you got bees covering 5, 6, 7 frames, and the queen's laying eggs, and she's got brood, and things are coming along as we are, you know, as normal as can be. What we need to do is take those good hives that have 5, 6 frames of brood and bee eggs and put them into 3 hives and put new queen cells in them and get them going so that we can get our numbers back up. You know, we're seeing that good side, but then yesterday morning we went out and did 1 yard, and about a third or better of them were just totally demoralizing. There wasn't a hand, half the size of the palm of your hand size of brood in them, if that, and not 100 bees, and, you know, it just that thing from last year, and I sit here and look at it and go, the half that yard was excellent, and the other half was just bad. They won't make it. It's a waste of time and money. For the life of me, I can't figure out why. How do you have good bees like that, and then you've got, you know, junk when they all came out of the same area up here in Minnesota, South Dakota?
That is an enigma. Any ideas at all? Any sort of gut reaction?
Well, the more I read, the more I don't know.
Right.
The ones that we shipped out in November from Minnesota was right at 10-11% loss. You know, that I can live with, but by the time we get them back to Texas the end of March, you know, if we have another 10% loss, well, then you're 20% again. And, you know, last year we had a 65% loss, so 20% looks pretty darn good in my eyes compared to last year.
Mm. So for you, it's been a little better year than the last year.
Very, very much so. I'm very thankful to the good Lord above, because it certainly isn't all my doings. I don't know. I have some friends that are having complete disasters now this fall, this winter again, and they didn't have any trouble last year.
Is there sort of a region that seems to be hit worse than others?
Nope. We're hearing reports of people from Arkansas that put their bees and took them down to Louisiana for the winter and lost all of them, to people that were in North Dakota that went down south that lost 50%. And we're talking somebody that has 20,000 hives of bees and only has 10,000 right now. Wow. And we were talking some big numbers there.
One of the great mysteries about this CCD is the fact that the bees just seem to disappear. One would think that one would start to find dead bees all over the place. Any progress in terms of determining what's happening with the bees? They just seem to disappear from the hives in many cases.
Well, that's true, and I still am a firm believer that part of our problem is the insecticides that are injected into the corn and beans, and the bees are picking up these minute parts of pollen that hold the DNA of that plant, and of course, you know, those chemicals are going to be in there.
The neonicotinoids.
Yeah, the neonicotinoids. You know, to me, that's the memory loss thing, and I can't explain anything else. And we're seeing that in these bees that, you know, that I talked about that are just junk, and they do have honey in them, and they're not being robbed out. The other bees are not touching them.
As I follow the press that comes out of this, the thing that amazes me is the fact that primarily this particular issue, the neonicotinoids, is never really much talked about. They're still talking about mites and other problems like that, and they kind of mention in passing the insecticides. Where do you come down on some of this?
Oh, I think that is part of our problem on my bees. I had a gas station attendant up in Minnesota call me and say, do you know that they're out here with planes and spray rigs spraying every soybean field aphids? And so I call the state and say, hey, they're spraying my bees and next to my bees and spraying in the daytime and they're spraying during bloom. And all I got from them was, well, unless you're out there looking at it, there's nothing we can do. And I'm thinking that's the bees that I'm having these problems with.
Yeah, I was curious about that. In terms of that you lost some bees and you didn't lose others, if there was some sort of way to figure out which bees were where when and may have been affected by those kinds of things.
Exactly. When I get home, I'll talk to my field manager and see if we can figure out, a roadmap of where these bees came from.
This is 2 years in a row now that beekeepers are really being hit hard. And I just have to imagine that at a certain point here, this is going to become very difficult to keep on maintaining the numbers and the health of the hives. Is there a point reached where this just is, where there's going to be sort of a tipping point, some sort of real collapse where there just really aren't enough bees? Do you kind of see that down the road? Are people talking about that?
I think it's in the back of everybody's mind. It certainly is in mine. When I testified last year for the House Ag Committee, I think it could be catastrophic at any time. Who knows? I mean, you hear stories, and then, of course, everybody's so proud that they can't tell the truth that their bees are all collapsing. But, let the truth be known, there's some real problems out there, and they're not going away. I don't think they'll go away in the next, few years.
Well, there's nothing to indicate that there's been a positive change. If you keep on cutting your numbers down by 10% or 20% or 50%, pretty soon you're in trouble.
That's true. The only lucky thing is that we're able to split our bees and hopefully get our numbers back. We did see this same thing last summer in some of our bees up in Minnesota, where they were two stories of bees boiling out, and a month later, they were down to one box, and they hadn't made a drop of honey, and, the ones next to them had three boxes of honey on them and looked great.
Hmm.
And these are all the same bees. They all came out of the same yard.
Hmm.
It's just puzzling.
Yeah, we're talking with David Ellingson, who's from Ellingson's Incorporated in Ortonville, Minnesota. How long have you been doing this, Dave?
Last year was I'm a second generation beekeeper in the family, so it's our 61st year right now.
Now, when you go back into the legacy, has anything like this ever in that 60 years hit you in the same way or as hard?
Not that I can recall. All I can recall is having two stories of bees that were boiling in the spring, and they were almost 98% of them were like that, and you didn't have these 10, 20, 35% losses.
Well, Dave, I wish you a safe journey, and I appreciate you sharing your situation right now. We'll keep in touch. I want to really stay on top of this story because I don't think it's getting the attention that it needs.
Well, I hope that everybody that's listening would take just a minute and call their congressman and their senator and express their concerns also, because it seems like we've been hammering on that door for years, even when I was vice president of the American Beekeeping Federation, and it's the deaf ears of getting any more funding.
Mm-hmm.
And we need more funding to figure this out.
This is my take on this, and I think it's a very complex problem. It seems as if, obviously, the neonicotinoids really are an effect. They really do the job, and they're being used all over the world. And therefore, you got a lot of farmers and others who are really happy with this, and they're vested interest to keep that happening. Of course, the pharmaceutical companies that make these things, I think it's primarily Monsanto and a few others, they really hit this one out of the park. They've got a product here that really does the job. Unfortunately, there is this dramatic and potentially devastating side effect, and there's just such big money involved that it's going to be a very difficult thing to try to find the truth, because perhaps no one wants to admit that this is something that's gone wrong. That's just my take.
Oh, you're definitely, you're right on that. They don't have to prove the EPA on sublethal effects. If it's the feeding of the bee bread with the pollens that maybe have minute amounts of this in it that causes that bee to die 3 or 4 or 5 days earlier than normal. We're going to have to do all that study, put all that money in as an industry to be able to come back and say, this is the problem. I think they know there's a problem. I think they know what's going on, and they're just going to sit there and deny it till the end.
This isn't the first time that nicotine has been involved with some shenanigans in terms of public health and cover-ups and things.
Exactly.
But I personally think that that's what we're looking at here. I don't exactly know how we're going to deal with this, but I think America and other people around the world have got to just face it. There's a problem here, and I'm certainly going to do everything I can to try to bring that forward.
One thing that surprises me, and I always ask people this, is especially in the Midwest, when's the last time you saw all these yellow butterflies flying out in the country? There used to be hundreds of thousands of them flying across the cornfields and the bean fields. you don't see any of them anymore. That's got to wake people up and realize that, you know, it's not just the bees and everything. It is everything else out there.
I agree with you totally. And no one talks about that. When I was growing up, springtime and summer was a time of butterflies everywhere. They were like jewels flying around. They were amazing and extraordinary.
Yep.
And I don't see butterflies anymore. I'm not in Minnesota. I can't talk about how it is there. But what is that kind of the way it is right now, that they're gone right now?
You just don't see them.
No, see, that's a huge loss. That's a huge story from my perspective.
Yeah. And people, they can relate to that. As soon as they say that, oh, yeah, I haven't.
I had a friend of mine growing up, George, and he collected butterflies. He had an extraordinary butterfly collection, and he was really good at that, about seventh grade or something like that. And there were hundreds of different species of butterflies that he'd mounted. I don't think anyone's collecting butterflies in those areas. Or if they are, there'd be many fewer species and much harder to collect.
I agree with you 100% on that one.
I'm going to talk about that because I think that's we need to really wake up here that we're losing so much. It affects us in many ways. Just the fact that these used to be miracles and miraculous parts of our life growing up and that they're gone is one big part of the story. Well, Dave, I wish you a safe journey. Thanks so much. We'll talk again.
Sure.
I'm going to maybe call you back a little later on in the summer to see how things are going.
Okay.
Okay, Dave. Thanks a lot.
Have a great day.
Thanks for joining us this week. And a quick reminder that this Friday is the launch of the Wildside News on YouTube, where I'll be speaking about bees. Join in for the premiere of the Wildside News Update. See you there. And I'll be here again next Tuesday or anytime on the archives. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world and on YouTube as well, here on the Wildside News.